You are listening to a Gustavus Afternoon, where we're stationed here at Water's Edge in Glacier Bay. I'm your host, Scott Burton. It's about 6 minutes past the top of the hour. Absolutely beautiful out here, 63 degrees and sunny. And with me now at Park Headquarters is Tom Vandenberg. He is the Chief of Interpretation here for the Park Service, and also Sonia Gray, who is a Park Ranger Cultural Interpreter Specialist. Welcome to the show, you two.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It is so nice to be here. Thank you for allowing us to be here. Shu Wu, Gunesh Chish, thank you for allowing us to be here. This is great. Tom, can we start with you? Describe for our listeners where we are. What are we looking at here?
Well, first of all, you guys picked probably the nicest day of the year to be in Gustavus and Bartlett Cove. It is unbelievable today. It is crystal clear. The Fairweather Mountains are in view in the distance. 15,000-foot high peaks in view. I mean, you can see over 100 miles right now. Cottonwoods are leafing out. There's migrating birds traveling through. There's otters in the lagoon out in front of us here. Green grass coming up. It is amazing. I don't even have the words to describe. We are on the shore of the what we call the Inner Lagoon, right in front of our Park Headquarters building.
How long has this Park Headquarters been here?
That's a good question. It's had several manifestations throughout its life. Actually, the room we're in right now used to be the auto or boat mechanics shop. And now it's an office building, and our actual main park headquarters building was once a small house for the one or two employees that used to be here. So the park has grown, our infrastructure has grown a little bit, and probably since the 1950s or so.
Okay. And here we are on the edge of the park. How big is this park?
This park is enormous, 3.2 million acres. It's one of our larger national parks. It's equivalent to the size of Connecticut, believe it or not.
Okay. And Sonia, we met you on Wednesday down at the Huna Tribal House where you were giving a presentation. How long have you and your people been here?
Oh my gosh. As they say, and from time immemorial. It's, of course, this venture here with the tribal house in the park, you know, is brand new, but it is, again, symbolic of our ties that are everlasting to this place. So we've been here a very long time.
And will you tell us about your heritage and where you're from?
Yes, I am born and raised in Huna. My clan is Takwenady, which comes from Prince of Wales, a Kwak region, my grandmother. My father is Wishkiton, which is one of the four major clans that settled this area. He is currently the clan leader. I was born and raised in Huna and raised my family there as well.
And we are going to put some pictures of this beautiful new structure on our Facebook page that our listeners can go look at. But for somebody who hasn't done that, will you describe what the Huna Tribal House looks like?
Oh my gosh. It is incredible, because when you come into Bartlett Cove, you see it as you start rounding into the dock area, but it's beautiful plank structure. On the front, of course, is designed with the eagle and raven, the two halves of our society, the moieties. In the front, of course, the door has a being with his hands spread open and palm showing, which is, of course, a sign of welcoming. And it's meant to be seen from a long distance, which means you're welcome here. Come in peace. And of course, adorned in the front are two totem poles that were raised just last spring in May, the eagle and the raven poles. And they are guardians. They watch over the bay. They host the crests of the clans that were not of the original four, but married into it. So like my clan, who is not of the original four, because I'm from Kluwak, is represented on the Raven clan. And it's very important. Again, you can see it from afar. And I'll tell you, one of the best experiences I've ever had with my chief here was going fishing up Bartlett River. And on our way back down, we'd simply float out with the tide. You come around a corner, and there's nothing else in view except that tribal house and the totems. Nothing else. And it was just meant to be. It always feels like it's meant to be right there.
Excellent. And maybe this goes out to both of you. Can you explain your role with the Park Service, your role with the Huna Tribal Association, the cooperation? And then I want to ask you, Tom, also to pitch in on how this house came to be.
Well, I think it's a unique role because, again, I'm not only a tribal member for the Huna Indian Association, lived, born and raised in Huna, but now I'm in a park uniform. And so I think I'm the the combination of both represented right there. At some point in time, that may not have been possible, but for me, I do wear it with pride because, you know, we do move forward and we have this great collaboration between the Huna Indian Association, the Huna Tlingit, and the National Park Service, which is a very healing collaboration. And so my job, I think, was to represent not just the history, but the meaning of place and what, you know, that that perpetuation of emotion and spirituality and belonging.
Okay. Thank you. And nice. Tom, take us back and how this came to be, this cooperation in the house.
Well, there's a long story of, I mean, this could be a program in itself, and I hear you may be going over to Huna in the future, and that would be a great opportunity to speak with some more of the elders and people that were involved maybe from the inception. But the story of the Park Service and the tribe hasn't always been a rosy one. There are many difficult years out there. As Sonia indicated, Glacier Bay has been the homeland of the Huna Tlingit people since time immemorial. They lived on these shores. They harvested from these waters. It was literally their bread basket. But the story of Glacier Bay is, you know, unending change. And a glacier advanced several hundred years ago, probably reaching its termination around 1750 near the mouth of the bay, forced the natives. The villages were destroyed. People had to flee, traveled out into Icy Strait, experienced some very, very difficult times, facing incredible environmental challenges at the time. They were forced to split up and travel in different directions, but eventually many of them reconvened near what's now the present day of Huna. Soon after, the glacier retreated, and they began moving back into their homeland. Of course, at that time, it looked very different. Destroyed by a glacier, just gravel and rocks and dirt, kind of a sterile area devoid of life. But they did return, and they began using the resources of their homeland here in Glacier Bay. And a national monument was created on top of it in 1925, which suddenly resulted in some very difficult times. There are regulations that go along with monuments and park service areas and harvest of resources, and very bad years of bad will between the park service and the tribe, lots of misunderstandings and really poor communication, essentially. Time has brought a lot of change and healing, and elders approached the park in around 1995, I believe, with the idea of some sort of house, some sort of physical manifestation of their culture. And the Park Service thought that was a great idea. And since that time, it took many years, but a lot of collaboration, a lot of meetings, a lot of working out differences, and realizing that we have a lot of the same goals, this tribal house finally came to be. They said it wouldn't happen, but it did. And now it's a jewel on the shore of Bartlett Cove. And it was, in its essence, even as Sonia mentioned, it's just a real symbol of collaboration. Collaboration between the clans, collaboration between the Park Service and elders and designers and architects and interpretive planners. And the result is this amazing facility that just welcomes all. And it's a new attraction here in Bartlett Cove. Very proud of it and very excited for visitors to come and learn more of that story with people like Sonia inside the house.
Sonia, do you remember when you first heard about the idea of this house?
Yes, I did. And again, I think I was one of those thought it was never going to happen. And any kind of government, you know, process is going to be long. And I thought maybe indoor past me. But I heard about it. And of course, I was actually up in Alaska doing my own research for a thesis for my anthropology degree. And I was missing the dedication in August by just mere days, and I couldn't change because my travel was paid for. And I was so upset, but I watched it live. And of course, my father, as one of the clan leaders, was in one of the two dugout canoes that was created in Hoonah. Now, when I returned to Hoonah, I saw this fervor, like the Wayne Price was doing the carving in the middle of town, and people were involved, children were involved. I heard of, you know, the dance troupe, the youth dance troupe, and singers were going to their troop leader's house on Friday night to practice. And I just saw this energy revitalization in Hoonah and knew it was going to be something special. So when I was watching live and saw, and it was like this crazy day where it was misty and cloudy in Bartlett Cove, and you see the prow of these two dugout canoes slicing through and coming ashore. And that could have been like literally 300 years ago. It was magical, even watching it on live feed. And it was
appearing
like this,
out of the mist.
Right. And people to this day that come back to the tribal house and who experience that, whether it be park rangers or community members of Gustavus or visitors who have come back multiple times, describe it in the same way, that it was just this powerful moment of coming ashore. And when I saw that and I watched as my father, my brother was helping my father ashore, I thought, I have to come back. I have to give back. And so out of nowhere, I get this notice of, hey, there's this job. I was just finishing up my degree and it seemed like to be perfect timing. Like it was written for me, in fact. And it was my way to give back not only to my community of Hoonah, but to my ancestors, to my culture. So it was very exciting. And thankfully with Tom's help, I was able to, you know, get here in the next spring.
And now how many presentations or talks do you do a week, let's say?
So I myself am actually the half, one half of two sides, because there's also a Hoonah Indian Association interpreter who does, we're going to have some overlap, but they do the days I don't. And we have programs that we do throughout the day. So once a week, I do an evening program in the tribal house, which is where I give the history and about the culture and the four clans and the little ice age. And it's a wonderful opportunity for me. Throughout the day, I give little orientations to visitors who come through, and I also give totem pole talks.
Okay, if you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Shu Wu, Sonia Gray. We are out here at Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve on one of the more beautiful days I've seen in a long time. We're also out here with Tom Vandenberg, Chief of Interpretation here at the park. It's great speaking with both of you. Tom, when did this become part of your story? I know this stint has been for 10 years, but you started coming here earlier, summers. Tell us about your participation in this.
Yeah, I first arrived in Glacier Bay as a summer hire, summer seasonal interpreter. I believe that was probably 1991, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I spent the next four summers here providing programming, guided walks, talks, working on cruise ships, tour boats, staffing the visitor center, my wife and I both for those years. And then the Park Service career took me away to a variety of other parks, in the Everglades and Great Basin National Park, Crater Lake National Park, Big Bend National Park, and then returned to Alaska about 15 years ago. And of those last 15 years, the last 10 years, I've been here year-round in Glacier Bay. I have a home in Gustavus, and I am now the Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services here. So I oversee all the folks that do the programs and support that whole big operation, a unique operation in the National Park Service.
What is your favorite thing to share about this park with visitors?
My favorite thing to share is just the wide open space. It is a huge landscape here, and a lot of our visitors are on vessels, tour boats, or cruise ships. And when you can take someone out on the deck of a ship and point to a feature and let them know that it's 2 miles wide, face of a glacier, kind of blows their mind. They're not used to seeing things on that scale, or that mountain is over a mile above our head, straight up from the shoreline. It kind of kind of warps their sense of reality a little bit. And it's exciting to open their eyes to just the immensity of the Alaska landscape. You know, a lot of our visitors come here on cruise ships, and it's the one day on their cruise where it's all about the Alaska scene. It's not about being in a port. It's not about touring around through the towns and all the activities. It's this is the day when you're experiencing Alaska scenery and wildlife and wilderness at its finest from the ship. And it's really exciting.
All right, we're going to take a break here in just a second. Before the break, Sonia, what is the favorite thing for you to share with visitors?
Oh my gosh, I think it's just the emotion that is evoked. I myself, like typical rangers, I get to go up bay and practice cultural interpretation, but also just do regular ranger duties and talk about the natural beauty. Every time I do go, whether it's rain, shine, stormy seas, or placid waters, there's always deep emotion and deep attachment. And I think like the tribal house, because every visitor that came to the door last season said, you know, that it affected them in some way. So I think it affects everybody. And if you're keen to those emotions, it's quite an experience.
You're listening to a Gustavus Afternoon. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast in Glacier Bay comes from Glacier Bay Cottage, located down a private trail at the Four Corners in Gustavus, and featuring a kitchen, full bath, washer and dryer, bikes, both upstairs and downstairs beds, and donkeys. Details with longtime local hosts Kate and Fritz at glacierbaycottage.com. And from the historic Gustavus Inn at Glacier Bay. Now for sale. Located 1 mile from the airport on more than 5 acres, the property includes the main inn, several outbuildings, a greenhouse, and 2 organic gardens. Information at gustavusinn.com.
You're listening to a Gustavus Afternoon, where we're going to continue our interview with Shu Wu, Sonia Gray, and Tom Vandenberg here at the Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. Tom, you were telling me that you actually ride alongside cruise ships, jump onto a ladder. Do you have like a lasso? Tell us how that works.
Starting the day off like a pirate.
A pirate in reverse. We're not there to take anything but give.
Yeah.
I did it just yesterday, and I'll tell you, it's cool every time.
Glacier Bay is unique in that we get a lot of visitors, actually over 500,000 visitors a year, but the vast majority of those do see the park on a cruise ship from the decks of a ship. And even on a ship, they're dwarfed in that landscape. It's an amazing day for those folks. But if we waited in Bartlett Cove for people to come to visit our visitor center and come to our programs, you know, our numbers would be pretty small and be waiting a long time. So in Glacier Bay, we bring all that to the visitor. Ships don't dock here at park headquarters. They don't come ashore anywhere in Glacier Bay. In fact, they don't even stop for us. In the morning, we board our small vessel. It's a 40-foot transfer vessel called the Siroc, and our little ranger team heads out to the mouth of Glacier Bay. We float around out there for a few minutes, and lo and behold, after a little bit, here comes the first cruise ship around the corner. We limit Glacier Bay cruise ship entries to 2 per day. On most days, there's 1 or 2 during the summer months. The ship comes up alongside. It'll slow down maybe about 6 or 7 knots or so. And we will come alongside and match speed. They'll drop a little rope ladder out of a hatch, and we come up right beneath the rope ladder and scamper up that ladder when everything is all set and stable. And then haul our visitor center up, which is in a little trunk, and we pull it up with a rope up the ladder. And then we'll be on board for the duration of the day as the ship travels all the way 65 miles up to the face of 1 or 2, 3 tidewater glaciers into the beautiful heart of Glacier Bay. And then we disembark the same process at the end of the day. And it's actually one of the highlights of the day for many of the passengers, just to see these rangers crawling down a rope ladder.
What do you think surprises those visitors most about the information you share with them?
Well, it's a great opportunity for us to get on these ships, because even though a lot of people are on the cruise specifically to come to Glacier Bay, it's one of their big selling points. They want to see glaciers. They want to see ice. You know, it's a disappearing type of world up there. And they seek out that experience, that visit to the ice ages. But there are also people on board that are just on a cruise. And they're not the typical people that might pack up the station wagon and head to a national park and meet a park ranger and go to a program. So we meet literally thousands and thousands of people and introduce them to the whole idea of what the National Park Service is and the fact that they own this. Everything you see, you know, it's theirs. And we just work for them. We're here sharing it with them, making it a special day, helping them discover and appreciate their natural heritage. And so we open a lot of eyes that way, and the appreciation we get is pretty powerful.
And Tom, I understand you were coming to the end of your stint here at Glacier Bay, and you were just speaking about the Park Service and what it means. What does it mean to you as you move away? What's the importance of the Park Service, and why have you dedicated probably a major part of your life to it?
Yeah, I started off going to parks when I was a little tiny kid. You know, every weekend we'd pack up the station wagon and head to the national park and hike and climb rocks and fish. And here I am now. I'm 51 years old, and I've truly dedicated my life to the National Park Service and the mission, preserving and protecting these places for present and future generations. It's been a great thing, a wonderful experience, and working with fabulous people like Sonia and People ask me what my favorite park is, and they're all my favorites. There's something special about a national park, or it wouldn't be a national park. So yeah, it's true. After 10 years, I will be transferring. I'm heading to Big Bend National Park down in remote West Texas. Be there in a couple of weeks, believe it or not. Okay. Trading whales and spruce trees for prickly pear and roadrunners.
Well, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
Sonia, thinking about your position here, mm-hmm. And you're speaking with individuals who come in, what is your message to them? What's the importance of you being here? What does it mean to you?
Yes, I think it's important, and I always strive to get this through to our audience, whether it's my own family and friends from Hoona or around Southeast, or if they're newcomers to the state, and that is, we are here. This is our home. It's not a representation of a past that has died, but a reminder of its perpetuation, and that we're together with the Park Service are completing this journey to come home and continuing it. So, you know, not to think of us as lost or somehow in the past, but just like the park and its many transformations in a short amount of time. If you think about it, like you ask Tom, what is one thing people are surprised about? To me, they are shocked that so much carving, so much formation and transformation has happened in a short span of time, in 300 years. The same goes for the Tlingit. In fact, that's what makes this Tlingit, is that we are adapting, evolving, transforming all of the time. So as much as the park needs us, we need them as well. And this is our journey together. And I think when people hear that, they get it, and it's a nice feeling. I think one of the highlights from last season, and I didn't know he was at the time, but was an ex-park ranger who came to one of my programs. And as he was leaving, he introduced himself and he said, "Thank you for telling the complete story of Glacier Bay."
Goodness geez. Thank you so much. That's Sonia Gray, Shu Wu, and we've been speaking with Tom Vandenberg here at the headquarters of Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. It's been a pleasure speaking with both of you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank
Thanks for having us here. Anything else that either of you would like to add?
I think we should mention a significant event that's coming at the end of the summer.
Yes, how could we forget?
Related to the Tribal House and that collaborative journey that we've been on with the Hoona Indian Association and the tribe. There's a healing totem that has been completed and will be being raised here in Bartlett Cove on August 25th. Mm-hmm. And that's a totem, a beautiful totem that tells the story of the tribe and Park Service relations over the years from bottom to top, from kind of a dark time and the exodus from the ice and the challenges they faced with the bureaucracy to today's Tribal House as we venture together on this journey. And it's going to be a pretty powerful event. So that's August 25th.
And open to the public.
That is, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So stay tuned for more releases on that. We'll let you know more about it.
Shu Wu, Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
calling out to you, Hashikinya. Great Spirit, our protecting power. Thank you for having mercy on us. Thank you. Exequan for your love. Thank you. For our strength, our body, our mind, and our spirit. Thank you for our knowledge. Thank you for our food. Thank you for our land. Thank you for our way of life. This life that you have given us, we are thankful.
Support comes from Blue Heron B&B at Glacier Bay, centrally located near cafes and markets. Rooms with private bath, two kitchenette cottages, and sunroom breakfasts. Custom tours, shuttle service, and bike rental available. Information at blueheronbnb.net.
You're listening to a Gustavus Afternoon where we're stationed at Water's Edge in Glacier Bay. I'm your host, Scott Burton, and it's about 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Joining us here at Park Headquarters in the Bay, we're with Christine Gabriel. She's a wildlife biologist, and Lewis Sharman, who is an ecologist here with the Park Service. Chris, Lewis, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Thanks.
So nice to have you. Let's start with you, Chris. Describe the scope of your work for us.
My role at the park here primarily is as a whale biologist. So I study the population of humpback whales that comes into Glacier Bay. In order to be able to understand the world from the perspective of the whale, we also monitor underwater sounds. Whales are very acoustically oriented animals, so we listen to the underwater sound and try to describe that as well.
All right, let's get to one of those sounds here in just a second. Lewis, what is your role here?
Well, I help coordinate a variety of research projects in the park. Much of that work is done by cooperators outside the park. Some of it is conducted by our own employees, and I have a few projects that I'm involved with as well.
You mentioned before the interview, this is a park for science rather than a science for the park kind of a place. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, it's actually both. Most parks facilitate scientific research to help answer questions that help them make decisions to manage the park. And we do that here at Glacier Bay as well. But Glacier Bay is a little bit special in that one of the reasons we were established was actually to provide opportunities for scientific research. So, and that's relatively rare within the National Park Service. So we think of ourselves as a park for science.
Okay, interesting. Let's talk about that more in a minute. Introduce us to one of the first sounds that we're going to hear, Chris. What should we expect here? What should we listen for?
Yeah. What I chose for us to play is a very common sound that the humpback whales make here in Southeast Alaska. And we think it's a sound that they use to contact each other. We call it a whoop because that's exactly what it sounds like. So I think what we're hearing here is two different whales calling back and forth to each other.
The whoop. Any idea what they might be communicating?
Probably something as simple as, I'm over here, where are you? But that's just a guess. We really don't know how it functions.
How many whales do you guess come through this bay every year?
We actually count them as individuals because the tails of a whale, the ventral side, the underside of the tail, has unique markings that are like a fingerprint. So in the course of our work, what we do is go out in a small skiff, find the whale, wait for it to dive, and take a photo of the tail. And with that, we can count the exact number of different whales that we see. In Glacier Bay itself, the maximum number we've ever counted was 160 different individuals. And in recent years, that number has started to fall a little bit.
What is it about Glacier Bay that those 160 whales come for?
Yeah. Well, the whales come to Southeast Alaska in general to feed. So this is their feeding range. During the course of their feeding season, a whale will spend, you know, up to 60 days or more in the Glacier Bay area, then maybe go over to Frederick Sound and eat some krill, go over to Sitka in the fall and winter to maybe have some herring. But in the Glacier Bay area, it's capelin is one of the main species of fish that they like to eat, as well as sandlands. And both of those, well, all of the things I mentioned are very high-calorie, oily food substances.
Okay. Lewis, in all of your research, what are you excited about right now?
Well, I think I guess if I had to pick up a project or an area of investigation that's most interesting to me, it would relate to just what Chris was talking about. And that is not so much why the whales come to Glacier Bay, but more about what they eat and why their primary prey sources are here in the first place. And so I'm really interested in what drives that vast amount of biological productivity that occurs in Glacier Bay. And that's why people come to enjoy Glacier Bay in large part, is to see those large whales and other wildlife that, as well as the scenery. So why are all of those large vertebrate predators coming here, and what's driving their food source? Why is the food source here?
And can you tell us about a few more of the critters that dwell here in the park?
Oh my gosh.
where to begin, right?
Where to begin? We have a variety of marine mammals as well as humpback whales. There are other species of whales, killer whales and harbor porpoises and things like that. There are several species of pinnipeds, like harbor seals and stellar sea lions. And then on land, there are many species of mammals, from bears to voles. And then I think about it. I can't remember how many species of birds, but we have a very high diversity of birds, both marine birds and land birds as well.
Okay. Did we maybe have the sound of a killer whale? Lewis mentioned killer whale. Were we able to get one of those?
Yes. Yes, there are two ecotypes of killer whales. And so one of them is the type that eats salmon, and that's called a resident killer whale. And I think I might have provided a sound for that. And the other type of killer whales eat marine mammals.
So which ones were these again, Chris?
I'm pretty sure that's a transient killer whale. Nope, resident type killer whale. And so those guys are out there hunting salmon. They prefer king salmon, don't we all? And they don't have to be quiet in order to hunt salmon because salmon don't have that excellent hearing. Whereas the transient types don't actually make as much sound because they're trying to sneak up on whatever marine mammal they're trying to eat.
Speaking of salmon, what are the salmon, Lewis, that we have here in the bay?
Well, at various times, we have all five species of Pacific salmon, from king salmon to pink or humpback salmon.
And what do they like to eat?
Well, mostly as adults, when they're feeding at sea, out in the open ocean, they're also eating small schooling fishes, those forage fishes that Chris was describing. But they also eat a wide variety of invertebrates as well. When they come to Glacier Bay to spawn, of course, when they're in spawning condition and headed upstreams, they typically are not eating.
Okay. You know, I'm looking at this map of Glacier Bay behind us, and I'm seeing the ice fields, all the glaciers, and probably all these drainages and streams. I imagine that this is all connected. What is it that comes out of those streams that helps engender this buffet of food, if you will?
I would say that, one would first think that, well, there must be some sort of material or food or nutrients or something that are emitted by streams that are contributing to the ocean environment that's sort of driving all this biological activity. But I would say that probably the more important contribution is just fresh water itself. And that contribution of fresh water helps the ocean in Glacier Bay set up conditions that are really favorable for phytoplankton production. And that phytoplankton is what drives all of the other biological productivity in Glacier Bay.
Okay. And some other mammals that seem to like Glacier Bay seem to be humans. And we come in ships and outboard motor-driven skiffs and sailboats. And I understand part of your research is to listen to those sounds. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah. We started monitoring underwater sound in the year 2000. And really, we were starting from nothing. We didn't really know what kinds of sounds contributed to the marine environment. But we knew that those sounds were important to a lot of the marine life that live in the bay. So we described the contribution of wind and rain and all these natural sounds, the occasional earthquake, as well as began to really make some good measurements of the kinds of the vessel sounds.
And you mentioned that marine mammals and other marine wildlife may hear sounds differently than we do.
Right. Yeah. So they do because unfortunately we don't actually understand what their hearing capabilities are very well. So we might play a couple sounds here. The one that sounds the loudest to us might not be the one that is the loudest to the whale, and that's because their best frequency of hearing, in other words, the pitch that they can hear the best, is probably a lot lower than ours.
Okay. Which one should we start with?
I think we should start with the cruise ship. So a lot of what you're hearing there is the propeller, that beating sound, and then the engines that are powering that propeller. And so you can see that's kind of a low frequency rumbling sound.
And again, it may be hard to sort of figure out how that does affect the critters in the bay.
Yeah, one thing that we know for sure is that we can measure, like we can estimate anyway, how much sound is impinging on the animal. So each vessel and kind of has a sound footprint around it. And what we can say is that if the whales, for example, are trying to communicate, they have kind of an area of space around them that they would usually be able to communicate in. We call that communication space. So if that whale said whoop, like that earlier whale did, if it was in quiet conditions, it might be able to reach a whale that was 4 kilometers away. Whereas if there's a ship going by or a vessel, all types of vessels contribute to the underwater sound environment, the amount of space that's available to that whale is diminished. to maybe a kilometer or less.
And speaking of whales, on Wednesday when we walked down to the Huna Tribal House, we went past Snow. Can you tell us the history and the story behind Snow the whale?
Yes. Poor Snow is an adult female humpback whale that was struck by a cruise ship as it was exiting Glacier Bay. Snow and another whale were trying to cross in front of the ship, and one of them didn't make it. And so we towed the carcass to shore. This happened in 2001, and preserved it for the sake of displaying it as an educational display. It could kind of make something positive out of a sad event. And it's really been an amazing process, both to put together the exhibit and have this educational opportunity, but also because the fact that there was a collision kind of transformed the Park Service's relationship with the cruise industry, knowing that collisions can happen. And in the past several years, we've begun to work together much more more closely to prevent collisions like that from occurring.
Okay, and for our listeners, we'll be putting a picture of Snow up on our Facebook page, so you can see that at KTOO's Facebook page. We're sort of running out of time here, you two, I'm sorry to say. Lewis, looking to the future, where do you think research here in the park should go or continue going?
I think there will always be unique opportunities for all kinds of scientific research here in the park, to answer questions that we don't even know to ask today. Glacier Bay is a really dynamic, changing place, always has been, always will be, and it'll offer really unique opportunities to conduct studies that are of interest to science and management as well. So it's hard to put my finger on any particular thing, but it's going to be an exciting thing to watch.
How about you, Chris? What's the future look like for you and where you'd like to see research go?
Well, in the underwater sound realm, I think that there's a lot to be discovered. As I was mentioning to you earlier, we have a lot of sounds that are happening out there that we don't actually know what the source of those sounds are. They're biological sounds. So the avenue for discovery is amazing.
Is that the knocking?
Yeah, the knocking.
Do we
sound.
Have the knocking?
Yeah.
Let's listen to that. So you don't know what this is?
Nope. It's a pretty formidable sound. It'll happen again, I think, in a couple seconds here. It seems like it's made on purpose. It's not just like a whale breaching or, you know, a sound that's happening like a sea otter cracking a shell. It's a purposeful sound of some kind. It may be maybe a fish. We really don't know.
I love that you're excited about a sound that you don't know where it comes from. It's inquiry, right? You get to find this out. This is part of your job as a scientist.
Absolutely. I feel greatly honored to have been able to watch Glacier Bay, the whale population, the underwater sound over all these years.
We've been speaking with Christine Gabriel. She is a wildlife biologist and also Lewis Sharman, an ecologist here at Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve. And it's been really great talking to both of you. I wish we had more time. Is there something that we're missing or something that you would like to add about your research, your work, something our listeners should know?
I just wanted to say that the reports of all our work, the acoustics as well as the whale population work, are on our website. You can Google Glacier Bay Whale Research or Glacier Bay Underwater Sound, and that'll take you right to the spot.
Okay, Lewis?
Well, we've talked a lot about research in the park today, and that is and will remain a primary purpose of the park. But along with that is just providing for enjoyment by the public. So I think we'd all like to really encourage the public to enjoy their national park, and the best way to do that is to come and visit. So we hope that folks in the listening area will make an opportunity to come to Glacier Bay.
All right, Lewis. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Support comes from Amy's Guest House, located in Gustavus and featuring three self-catering apartments, all surrounded by wildflower meadows and close to cafes, galleries, and grocery stores at the Four Corners. Bicycles available. Information at glacierbayalaska.net.
Thank you for tuning in to a Gustavus Afternoon. We've been here at Park Headquarters in Glacier Bay National Park, here on our second day in Gustavus. Thanks to everyone who has contributed to helping these shows take place. A big thanks to Melanie Lesh out here in Gustavus, part of the KTOO Board of Directors who helped facilitate this trip. Want to invite our listeners here in Gustavus and Juneau, it's probably not too late to get over here tonight, 6 p.m. at the Outpost. We're going to be having a community potluck and open mic jam. So come on out. Again, that's 6 p.m. in Gustavus Friday night at the Outpost. It's currently 63 degrees and sunny here in Bartlett Cove at the National Park. Tomorrow's forecast for this area here in Gustavus calls for 57 and a chance of rain. Tune in on Monday. I'll be your host again here on a Juneau Afternoon, where we'll speak with Allison Marks. She's the designer of this year's celebration art. The Juneau Police Department will come in and let us know what they're up to, and we'll also hear about Pride Week. Also, Huna Lookout, we are looking for a time to come over for a Huna Afternoon. We're excited. Send me an email at scott@ktoo.org. Help us find some guests and a good time to come over to Huna. Big thanks to David Purdy over here engineering for us, Cheryl Snyder. Thank you so much, and we'll see you soon.